UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to Prof Talk. I'm your host, Farha Khan. Today I have the pleasure of having medieval historian Dr. Courtney Booker on the show. Courtney Booker received his PhD in medieval European history from the University of California, Los Angeles, where he studied with Patrick Gary and was the Lynn White Junior Fellow at the UCLA Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. In 2003, he joined the history department here at UBC, where he now is an associate professor and chair of medieval studies. He has written on a variety of topics, ranging from a study of the 10th century manuscript preserving the first appearance of the French language, to the iconography of purple-dyed gospel books in late antiquity, to the theatrical consciousness of early medieval authors and their modern historiographers. His book, Past Convictions, The Penance of Louis the Pious and the Decline of the Carolingians, is about the contested memory of the public penance performed by Charlemagne's son, Emperor Louis the Pious, in 833. Dr. Booker joins me now live in studio here in CITR. Thank you, Courtney, for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So you just taught a class and you came running here from your class. Mm-hmm. Tell us what class you're teaching this term.
The medieval class I'm teaching is Introduction to Medieval Studies. It's Medieval 200 for first and second year students, largely. It's a year-long class, and the first term we look at, the rhetoric of decline during the 9th century, the Carolingians. We look very closely at a variety of early medieval texts of the 8th and the 9th centuries. And look at their rhetorical strategies and pay close attention to the ways that the authors wrote them and the polemics involved. The second term, we switch gears a little bit and look more broadly at notions of forgery and authenticity in the Middle Ages, and look at notions of authorship, look at notions, well, connected notions, authorship, authenticity, and authority, and then ultimately value. So that's what that class is about.
Now, Courtney, you're a medieval historian, but a large part of what you do is research. But of course, you teach as well. And it's said that your passion for teaching and learning brings the medieval period to life in many ways. Why is teaching students about medieval history so important to you?
Why is it so important? Simply to give students an idea about the depth of the past, of the way the modern period is extremely different from what went before, to give them a sense of perspective. Here's something that's very self-evident, but look at this shift in notions of the written word. In my classes, we look at, say, the shift from roll to codex. That's one moment where you have a transfer of information from one medium to another. And of course, in any moment like that, you have a lot of things that, of course, are preserved, but even more importantly, the things that, are decided to be left aside. The roll to codex shift happens in the 2nd to 3rd centuries AD or CE. The next big shift then occurs, as you probably know, from the written word, handwritten word, manuscript, to the printing press. And this happens with Gutenberg. And then the most recent shift that's got lots of attention, if you read the New York Times, you'll see a piece on it every couple of weeks, is the shift from the printed book to the digital form of media. So, and you know, there's all kinds of hand wringing that occurs. That's been occurring about this most recent shift and what kinds of things are not being digitized and what's going to happen to that knowledge and how ought it to be preserved. And so you know, that's just one example of the ways in which learning about the ancient and medieval past brings a greater perspective to problems, say, in the present.
Now, you won a very prestigious prize, the UBC Killam Teaching Prize, a couple of years ago. And it was said when you were given the prize that your interactive teaching style inspires your students to become historians themselves instead of simply students of history. Is that sort of what you aim to do in some ways?
I don't want to make every one of my classes a professional historian. There are no jobs. But I do want to make people think historically. I want them, as I said, to have a sense of historical perspective about their lives, about the world. I want them to think about knowledge in that way. So anytime they come across a piece of knowledge, to think how we have that knowledge, and what form does it appear? Why does it appear in that form? What are the historical implications of that particular form? On and on. So just the recognition of historical depth is important, and I try really to convey that and to turn my students into, to sensitize them to the notion of history, I guess.
How did you feel when you won the prize? Because it's a prize that's nominated by, you know, students and colleagues and peers and that kind of thing. So it's, how did you feel when you heard that you won it?
I was deeply flattered, obviously. It was a nice capstone, I have to say, to the first part of my career, which is that I received it just after, just before going on sabbatical, my first sabbatical. So, and then just prior to being promoted to associate professor. So it was a quite nice milestone, I should say.
Great. Now, you're currently the chair of medieval studies at UBC. Can you tell us about the program and what you currently do?
What do I currently do? The main thing, I suppose, as chair of medieval studies is I help to organize and oversee the annual conference on medieval topics. It's the medieval workshop. It's been happening for over 30 years at UBC. It's going to happen next month down at Green College, and this year it's on the topic of mirrors in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, which is a quite interesting topic. So I help those people who are organizing that conference. I also oversee the curricula for medieval studies as a discipline at UBC, and there are a number of medieval studies classes. As I said, I teach the second year medieval studies introductory class, which is interdisciplinary, and then there are some third year broad literature surveys for medieval studies, typically taught by people in the English department, but sometimes by people in the French, Hispanic, and Italian studies department. And then there's also occasionally the opportunity to take a fourth year seminar in medieval studies and to write a thesis. And I had a student a few years ago who wrote a medieval studies thesis on an early medieval author, the quite erratic and mysterious Bishop of Tours by the name of Gregory. And that was a superb thesis, and it was a lot of fun. So, overseeing the workshop, overseeing the medieval studies curriculum, just getting people excited about the pre-modern past, I should say. Doesn't even have to be just medieval. It can also be the ancient world, of course, too.
Mm-hmm. So, can you tell us about some of the papers you'll be presenting at that workshop?
I'm presenting one, but there are, you know, a number of things. Conferences available. Information about the conference is available on the website. So if you go to the Medieval Studies website, UBC, you'll see a link to the program. I'm speaking on a topic related to the Carolingians. The Carolingians are a dynasty of the 8th and the 9th century in Western Europe. I tend to focus in a lot of my work on the reign of Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious, who reigned from 814 to 840. Since the topic of this year's workshop is mirrors, I'm looking at a genre of literature in the, well, in the pre-modern world, if not later, called literary mirrors. Literary mirrors being texts written in such a way to espouse various ethical and virtuous precepts to the reader. Books of advice in many ways, but usually of ethical maxims or principles. In the Middle Ages, many of these things were written particularly for kings to guide kingly or royal behavior. We have a number of these things written for Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious. And I'm looking in my paper in particular at a moment shortly after Louis the Pious was dethroned and he regained his throne. This is in 834. And right after regaining his throne, it's very interesting, he sends a letter to the abbot of Saint-Denis requesting a manuscript or a book to be put together or compiled with all the writings that the abbot could find about that particular saint, Saint-Denis. Louis the Pious looked to him as his patron saint and as his guide in action because he felt that all earthly guides up to that point seem to have failed him. So it's a very interesting and particular kind of literary mirror that is cast in a particular saintly mode, I should say. So I'm very interested in that book and what Louis sought to get out of it and how perhaps his rule changed from 834 when he ordered this book to be made for him, which he said he carried around with him wherever he went until he died in 840.
That's very interesting. Now, your recent book, Past Convictions, The Penance of Louis the Pious and the Decline of the Carolingians, was published in 2009 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. What was the most rewarding part, in your opinion, of writing the book?
Most rewarding. Well, the book, of course, as many academic monographs are, it's a deeply revised version of my dissertation. The dissertation took shape and was written between about 1996, 1997, and 2002. And then, you know, it was revised from about 2003 to 2009. So it was a long time in the writing and revising. So it's hard to imagine the most rewarding moment. I suppose it came early on when I had my initial insight, I guess, which is that as many people who are writing their dissertations do, you read very, very broadly at the beginning, read lots and lots of work, both secondary scholarship and the primary documents. And I had done all that. And I was, you know, I had various interests, but nothing really gelled until I read the work of the theoretical work of Hayden White. Hayden White on notions of narrative and especially his theories about emplotment. And that made a lot of sense to me as insofar as it related to the kinds of texts I had been reading in from the early Middle Ages. And in particular, it caused me to focus my attention on the use of dramatic language within those texts. And I became very interested in the use of the word tragedy in early medieval texts. And that people have paid close attention to the use of that word in the early Middle Ages because there was no living tradition of drama. So drama, dramatic performance, died out as a living tradition, we think, around the 6th century. We have no textual evidence of there being any living tradition. Yet, there were plenty of texts of playwrights from Roman antiquity and Greece that survived. And so I became very interested in what these texts meant to monks and other scribes who were reading them and copying them within a historical environment that knew no living tradition or practice of drama. So the traditional explanation for this is that they copied these texts, that they were interested in them purely for matters of form rather than content. So ignore the content. The content is the work of the devil. We don't look at this pagan content. Rather, the actual literary form, the style of the Latinity is so beautiful that we keep it, we preserve it, we copy it in order to learn from, in order to write our own works in a high Latin style. I found that a rather superficial explanation, and what I began to find in a lot of my readings, is that some of this dramatic language began to creep into texts being produced in the 9th century that had nothing to do with drama, but and yet this language was being used in a rather sophisticated way as a means to both interpret and represent whole movements or whole sequences of events. You know, for instance, the deposition of a king, in this case Louis the Pious, being referred to as a tragedy. And so it's very interesting. I began to think, like, what does that mean when a monk is calling the deposition of a king a tragedy and he's never seen a tragedy before? In what ways does his characterizing that event as a tragedy lend shape to the narrative as a whole that he is telling? What kinds of things does it cause him to leave out of his narrative? What kinds of things does it cause him to include? And so Hayden White really pointed me in that direction when I was reading his work. So that's a long-winded way of saying that's probably what got me, what was the most rewarding thing in the process of doing my book.
How did you first become interested in Louis the Pious, and why did you choose to write about him?
That's another good question. One of the reasons is that I was always interested in the early Middle Ages. And then within the early Middle Ages, the Carolingian period of the 8th and the 9th century was a draw, simply because there's a relatively greater amount of material to work with. So the so-called Carolingian Renaissance of the 8th and the 9th century, it simply means that there was a great revival and interest of texts of the past, and there was a lot of copying, reproduction of these texts, a lot of literary activity. So there's a lot to choose from, a lot of very interesting things being written. But within that context, the dynasty or the era of Charlemagne proper, who dies in 814, this period during the late 8th and the early 9th century, there's the educational reforms that Charlemagne is undertaking are really picking up steam, but they haven't really flowered yet in terms of what they would produce. And it's only during the reign of his son, Louis the Pious, that you get a lot of people who are now finally educated enough to begin to produce a great deal of work. And ironically, the stuff that they begin to write about and produce as the result of this educational reform is the way in which the empire is falling apart. And so I became very interested in this very learned rhetoric of decline, of the way things are getting worse all the time, and yet the sheer number of people talking about this in the very sophisticated ways that they are talking about it belie the very notion that things are in decline. I'm also interested in a king who has been largely misunderstood, I think, throughout the centuries, and focus has always been placed upon his father, who is very strong, powerful, who did all these things, and you get poor old Louis the Pious, and I was quite interested in looking at him and his achievements, or lack thereof, I should say.
Tell us about some of your early career mentors.
I was very lucky in that when I was an undergraduate, I was at UC Santa Barbara, and you know, I was a history major, but I didn't really know what I wanted to focus on. And there, they happened to have a number of medieval historians. Oddly, they had three medievalists within the history department: Sharon Farmer, C. Warren Hollister, and Jeffrey Burton Russell. And they were wonderful teachers. And I very quickly became inspired by their teaching. And I also should say I was inspired by a teacher in the religious studies department there by the name of Walter Capps. He was a great teacher of monasticism. And from there, I then went to graduate school at UCLA. And at UCLA, I again had the great fortune, it was not by planning, but just a great stroke of luck, to fall under the supervision of Richard Rouse, who is a paleographer, someone who studies manuscripts and handwriting in the history department, and Claudia Rapp, who is a scholar of late antiquity, Bengt Lufstedt, who was a scholar of medieval Latin, Teofilo Ruiz, who is a scholar of late medieval Spain, who I just found out yesterday was received an award from President Obama, which I thought was pretty interesting. And then above all, my supervisor, Patrick Geary. And Patrick Geary really is a remarkable medievalist and a remarkable scholar. Many of these people are no longer at UCLA. Patrick Geary now is at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. Theo Ruiz is still at UCLA, but Claudia Rapp is now in the University of Vienna. Bengt Lifshitz has passed away, and Richard Rauss has retired. But it was just a terrific group of scholars at UCLA who complemented one another so well. And I think the 90s at UCLA and the history department were a very special time. There were some great people there.
Can you describe just a little bit about your background and your journey to becoming a professor here at UBC?
My journey, I'm not sure how to answer that question. Can you ask it a different way?
Yeah, so why did you choose to become a medieval historian?
Oh, I see. Why did I see? I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, and I knew that, the various people under whom I had studied were really great role models. Like I said, C. Warren Hollister, Sharon Farmer, Jeff Russell at UC Santa Barbara. And then once I got to UCLA, that was only confirmed by just equally great people. But why medieval? There are all the obvious reasons. I, like so many other people, when I was a kid growing up, I liked, fantasy literature, like J.R.R. Tolkien and that kind of stuff. Back in the 70s when I was a kid, between like fifth grade and eighth or ninth grade, I, like a lot of boys, played Dungeons and Dragons. But even more, perhaps more strangely, my father owned a circus in California, and he would do quite unusual things, like he would joust in the circus. I wouldn't say that was an inspiration for becoming a medievalist, but it certainly made me familiar with certain things. However unhistorical they were that he was doing. I suppose that's, and then just the curiosity. I'm very interested in that all the various things about the pre-modern world, like this world of manuscripts, like this world of monasteries, a world in which you don't have, for the good sections of the Middle Ages, you don't have central authority. So what is it like living in a world without law? How does that work? How do people resolve disputes? How does one live one's life in that environment? So, yeah.
What advice would you give to other inspiring historians?
What advice would I give to other aspiring historians? At the undergraduate level, you mean? let me tell you one thing. I've just been going through some applications for graduate school from undergrads, and one thing I would tell potential candidates for graduate school is, above all, take the time to go on the internet and look at the various institutions you're applying, look at their departments, look at the faculty in their departments, see what they